Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss the personal politics of health. When did preventative medicine become preemptive treatment of symptoms with pharmaceuticals? Didn't prevention used to mean exercise, a prudent diet, stress reduction, and thinking happy thoughts? And whose responsibility is prevention of disease? Is it the so-called victim? Is it the public health system? Is it the government and regulation of toxins and the zoning of walking in fume-free cities? And when did symptoms become diseases anyway? Health practitioners, both alternative and conventional, rely on a panoply of potions, remedies, and drugs to alleviate symptoms. When do our expectations exceed actual healing and hurt us? With us to examine these questions is Ray Moynihan, co-author of Selling Sickness. Stay with us. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, Ph.D.
Thank you, Lena. You'll find a good example of bad science journalism in the latest issue of The New Scientist. There's a teaser on the cover that says, "The Antioxidant Myth, How We Fell for a Medical Fairy Tale." The bulk of the article is devoted to describing research that alleges no benefit from taking antioxidant supplements. The gist of the article is this: populations with diets of antioxidant-rich foods have better health. Tests in the lab on cell cultures show that antioxidants reduce harmful free radicals. Yet when clinical trials are conducted with antioxidant supplements, the outcomes are disappointing. It's not until the end of the article that a dissenting voice is heard. A representative from the Council for Responsible Nutrition points out that antioxidants don't work like drugs, that antioxidants work together. The article lingers not on this topic, but does take the time to note that the Council is the trade organization for supplement manufacturers. You, the reader, are smart enough to know what that means. Dismiss what they've said because it's obviously biased. Let's start here with why this is bad science journalism. The Council's view is shared by a wide range of researchers and practitioners. Why wasn't someone from, for instance, the Linus Pauling Institute interviewed and quoted? Because it wouldn't give the odor of bias provided by a quote from a trade organization. Speaking of odor, the author of the article, quote, "is science writer in residence at the Novartis Foundation in London," end quote. Novartis is a leading pharmaceutical company. Pharmaceutical companies and the science that blossoms from them don't like vitamins and minerals, at least unpatented vitamins and minerals. But I digress. Or maybe not. The shameful thing about this article and the editorial that covers it, what makes it bad science journalism, is its gross bias and condescension. Let me review the bias very quickly. A major criticism of antioxidant clinical trials is their faulty design. In addition to the very important issue regarding how antioxidants work together, these experiments often ignore the test subjects' unique metabolism and nutrient status. Practitioners and civilians who successfully use antioxidants and other supplements know this. Antioxidant clinical trials have also been sloppy about what form of antioxidant the researchers use. The condescension is perfectly captured by the cover's subtitle, "How We Fell for a Medical Fairy Tale." The New Scientist's editorial centers on their receiving supplements from a PR firm and how, by golly, they weren't going to fall for that nonsense. The article itself bemoans the alleged fact that, despite all of the great science showing antioxidant supplements don't do anything, people will continue to take them. We're just a gullible bunch of yahoos towed around by the promise of health made by unscrupulous sellers of potions and nostrums. You see, you and I are too stupid to realize when we're being conned. The objective scientific folks at The New Scientist, on the other hand, have a firm grasp of the evidence, have decided that antioxidants don't work, and believe that you're a fool to think otherwise. The Enlightenment philosopher Spinoza observed that because we are finite creatures, we of necessity view the world from a perspective. He thought we should strive to understand that perspective so that we are not its captives. The New Scientist is not alone in allowing its perspective to degenerate into bias. The problem is that they don't think they have a perspective. They have science, so they can't be biased. I think you and I know better. The antioxidants don't work is the real antioxidant myth here. For a copy of this transcript, go to our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Thanks, Jeff. Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett, Ph.D., is a political economist, writer, and health educator who works with individuals. He co-produces this radio show and is the editor of the Progressive Health Observer, a news commentary alternative to Big Box Medicine. You can reach him by going to our website, or you can call him directly at 707-874-1496. And now to our topic, which is turning people into patients. And our guest, Ray Moynihan, it's spelled M-O-Y-N-I-H-A-N, Moynihan. He is the co-author with Alan Cassells of the book Selling Sickness, How the World's Biggest Pharmaceutical Companies Are Turning Us All Into Patients. Ray Moynihan is the recipient of several major journalism awards, including the 2003 British Medical Journal Association Award, an author and journalist. He's currently medical writer for the Milbank Memorial Fund in New York, visiting editor and regular contributor to the British Medical Journal, and regular guest speaker at medical journalism conferences around the world. Based in Australia, Moynihan has held a Harkness Fellowship in healthcare at Harvard University and writes regularly for both mainstream and scientific journals in the UK, USA, Europe, and Australia. And we're thrilled to have you here in the United States for an interview. Welcome to you.
Hello, Lena.
What a lovely accent you have. That's very pleasant. My first question is maybe a bit obvious. You and Alan Cassells have sort of added this book to several others that do a pretty good job of showing up the pharmaceutical industry as the scoundrels they are. What is the issue that you're bringing up in this book that distinguishes it from those by Marcia Angel, MD, John Abramson, MD, and Bartlett and Steele?
Good question, Lena. Our book has come out at a time when there's a whole raft of books and media outrage and public concern about the power of Big Pharma and the way Big Pharma abused that power. Our book is very different. It specifically looks at how drug company marketing strategies are essentially turning us into patients. It looks at the way the marketing strategies affect our definitions of disease. Many of the other books that you mention look more at the way the drug company marketing of drugs can lead to distortions in prescription and various other things. And indeed, those other books do a great job, I've got to say. They also look much more deeply than that. But our book explicitly looks at the range of marketing strategies and the way they impact on the very definitions of illness and who qualifies for treatment.
Ray, I have a question about the, as it were, the ground on which the marketing pitch falls, that it this phenomenon of invention of disease with pharmaceutical companies starts maybe about 30 or 40 years ago when they found an opportunity and took advantage of it. What I'm wondering is if you could talk about within the practice of medicine and medical research itself, why was the blandishments of pharmaceutical advertising so effective?
Well, I think that pharmaceutical advertising is just one of the strategies, one of the marketing strategies that companies use. And as we talk about in the book, there are a whole range of strategies. And so the advertisements to the public are very effective. All the kind of gifts and blandishments and inducements to physicians are very effective. Companies are now funding patient groups. That is a very effective strategy. Companies fund the very regulator itself. The FDA, of course, relies on drug company money to function as well. So there are many strategies. The companies now employ celebrities to help sell their ideas about disease. So there are lots of strategies, both explicit and clear and available for everyone to see, like the ads on the television, but there are lots of more, you know, subterranean strategies. So it's very hard to avoid the influence of the pharmaceutical industry, and it has been for some time. But that influence is growing, and I want a public debate about how that influence affects the definition of disease.
You know, there's an expression, find a need and fill it, which describes kind of capitalist society, a consumer society. And essentially all the pharmaceutical companies have done, although they do it in a rather underhanded and aggressive, almost kind of cowboyish way, is they've found a market and they're making use of it. They're taking advantage of it in every way they can. But the market, the fact that people are vulnerable to this, the fact that there was a need, speaks to something about the way the medical industry is practiced in the Western United States and parts of Europe. So there's something that they were able to fall into that was already available to them that made this work so well. And that's, I think, the real question.
I think that's right. And I think that there was a Greek god of healing called Asclepius, and one of his children was Panacea, the goddess Panacea. This is in Greek mythology.
Right.
And I think the goddess of Panacea, or goddess Panacea, is one that all of us, whatever our creeds are, worship. We particularly when we're vulnerable or sick, we want a quick fix. We want a panacea. We want a cure-all. And I think there's that need in everyone. No one wants to suffer. And I think that it's that worship of panacea that makes us all even more vulnerable to marketing strategies that play to that vulnerability. And so I think you're right. There is something in the way we think about healthcare and our real need for cures and for treatments that alleviate our suffering and extend our life, and so that's the sort of bed in which these marketing strategies can work.
There's something here about whose responsibility is all of this, and one of the problems here is that consumers have abrogated their responsibility and given it over to experts, and doctors have abrogated their responsibility and given it over to experts. So everybody is turning to the experts, and the experts are turning to other experts. One of the problems I find over and over again is when you examine research, you have to ask yourself, which research are you looking at? Because there is so much credible scientific research that is done very beautifully, very lovely design, you know, designed research that never gets published and never gets disseminated, and other research which is so patently flawed and corrupt, and that's the basis on which everybody's making decisions. So there's a real problem with whose responsibility is it, and I think Jeff had something on that, didn't you, about, no? Anyway, go ahead.
No.
Okay, go ahead, Bray, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I think that this issue of credibility and trust with researchers is a big one. I'm just, as we speak, at a workshop in the Rocky Mountains, which is all about evidence. It's the evidence-based healthcare workshop, and I'm tutoring here, as I do every year, tutoring a small group of journalists. And this workshop is all about how to distinguish between reliable evidence and unreliable evidence. And it's a fairly rigorous scientific place, and so there are ways in which people, physicians, consumers, journalists, policymakers can try and sort out the decent evidence from the not so decent evidence. And one of the things to look for, of course, is who has paid for the study, who has paid for the evidence, who has sponsored the study, what are the conflicts of interest of the researchers. That's one of the things. It's not the most important thing necessarily, but it's one of the things. So I think it's very hard for anyone these days, given the sort of overload of information, and particularly in the healthcare area, it's very hard for anyone to sort out what's reliable and what's not. But there are ways of doing it, and I think slowly we'll get better at discerning what's good from what's not.
This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm in the studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD, and I have Ray Moynihan, M-O-Y-N-I-H-A-N, author with Alan Cassells of Selling Sickness on the line. We're talking about turning people into patients. I just want to take you to task a little bit for something, if I might. One of the examples of flawed research from my perspective, and it's one of the ones that makes me completely livid, is the WHI study, which you actually, I think, hold up as a good piece of research. In fact, it is paid for by the pharmaceutical industry. It was done 10 years after research was done using synthetic, patented, manipulated Provera, which is doesn't match the molecular structure of the progesterone that people make in their bodies, and it was shown 10 years ago to promote cancer, and to interrupt the protective effects of estrogens, and yet they went ahead and used an oral horse estrogen on these women without testing their levels and Provera. And indeed got the desired effect, which is to spend a lot of the taxpayers' money and have the study yanked because there were all these bad effects. They went back and did a study with estrogen alone, again using horse estrogens, again not testing women for their levels. Horse estrogens are not bioidentical to women. And no surprise, the newspapers were splattered with these headlines about doubling the clotting risk. But when I got hold of the WHI study and combed through it very carefully, what I discovered was that the people who were taking estradiol alone had half the amount of breast cancer of those not taking it. It wasn't reported on because statistical significance is 0.5 and this was 0.6. There was remarkable changes in bone mass and it protected them from colon cancer and other things that were kind of downplayed in the studies. All they mentioned was the clotting. And normal clotting incidence is 0.1% in 100,000 people, and this went up to 0.2%. But who gives estrogen alone to postmenopausal women who have none of their other hormones in balance? So that's an example to me of research that's taken seriously that was an incredible, appalling waste of the taxpayers' money. So forgive me for jumping on you, but I'm...
No, that's fine. I mean, I think we could debate that study all day. It's a very big study. I mean, I think my understanding is that it's largely a taxpayer-funded study.
Largely what? I'm sorry?
Taxpayer-funded. It's largely a publicly funded study.
No, it was also funded by the pharmaceutical company.
I think the pharmaceutical industry provided the therapies, provided the tablets for it, which is certainly a significant cost. But apart from that, I think the bulk of the money came from the public purse. As to the comments specifically about estrogen alone, I'm not as familiar with the study as others might be, so I really wouldn't want to comment on that.
Okay. Jeff, you had something.
Kind of to back up a little bit, there are kind of two lines that I think of when I think of bias in research and presentation of results. And one of those you've talked about, which is, call it dramatically, corruption in science, that unnecessary influence from pharmaceutical companies influences the design, which actually I think is where a lot of the bias comes from, and even interpretation of results. But there's another aspect to this that is that is actually, to me, more powerful, but then I'm a social scientist, which is the institutional arrangements. And in my view, the fertile ground that pharmaceutical advertising fell on within the medical professions was the shift in orientation of medical practice that happened 50 years ago from treatment of acute conditions to prevention, so that a good deal of the conditions that the invented diseases that you discuss in your book are in fact not about treating real diseases, they're about treating not even symptoms of diseases, but they are attempts to prevent diseases. And while trying to prevent disease is of course an important issue, The question that you raise in your epilogue is, where's the right place to, who is it that should be responsible institutionally for defining what is disease and what is health? So I'm wondering if in the course of your researching the book, you had looked into that, that kind of broader issue of kind of institutionally, what is it that makes the pharmaceutical industry so successful in marketing what they're marketing?
Yes, I think the point here, I guess, is you're right, is that a lot of the energy that is expended in the medical system now is on preventive therapies, preventive treatments, and a lot of those treatments are aimed at risk factors that many people have. So high blood pressure, high cholesterol, osteoporosis, these things are risk factors for future illness. High blood pressure, high cholesterol are risk factors for future heart attacks. Osteoporosis, which is the thinning of the bones, is a risk factor for future fracture. And so when you start looking at risk factors and treating risk factors, you start to treat a lot more people, a lot more relatively healthy people. Now, some people argue that is a good thing, because if you treat people early and you change their behavior or you give them drugs, you will help reduce the number of bad events down the track. You will help reduce the number of fractures. You will help reduce the number of heart attacks. And I would say that as long as people have all the information, then they can make that decision. Where I think the problem is that these risk factors have now been framed or described or presented or portrayed as diseases in their own right. And I think that's where the problem has come in. So you have many, many relatively healthy people essentially fearing that they suffer from an illness, whether it's hypertension or high cholesterol or particularly osteoporosis, which is one where there has been a lot of what's been described as the marketing of fear. And so, yes, there are large institutional interests within medicine and within healthcare that have built large empires on these new preventive therapies. Now, I think it's also fair to say that a lot of illness, a lot of this really falls along a spectrum. So you have people at the low risk end and at the high risk end. So risk isn't just a simple concept. And for people at very, very high risk of suffering from a particularly bad outcome, it probably makes a lot more sense to them for them to start thinking about how to prevent that outcome. And so that's where the argument will kick in that says, well, it's good to give osteoporosis drugs to people at very, very high risk, or it's good to give drugs to people at very high risk of heart attack, and I'm inclined to think that that's a reasonable argument. Where I differ from a lot of people in this field is I think that people at very, very low risk of these bad events are possibly wasting a lot of money and expending a lot of energy worrying when they don't need to. And there's an awful lot of people now at relatively low risk of experiencing these events that are essentially seeing themselves as patients. And that's what the book's really about.
There's a more sinister underbelly to this as well. If you give a person, as you point out, somebody has a blood pressure of 160 over 90, but has everything else in his life is good. He exercises. This is a man. He's vigorous. He has no early heart attack in his family line. His diet is prudent, blah, blah, blah. And as people age, their blood pressure tends to be a little bit higher. So why should this be treated? The other side to this is that both Jeffrey and I are health educators, and we see people as clients where we discuss some of these things. And what we see more than anything else are medical victims, people who are very healthy and who start on this train where they give them one medication, and the medication causes terrible side effects, which are actually the effects of the medication, and then they are given more stuff and more stuff and more stuff, and by the end of this, you know, after a year has gone by, they really are quite ill, because even though the industry is protecting itself from negative research, even the research they put up as proving the positive effects of these things, you know, to use an example of the osteoporosis medications or the hypertension medications, their own results are unremarkable. And you talk about the manipulation of numbers and data to make it look like they are doing more than they're doing. So the thing I'm trying to say is both that the numbers are manipulated and they're unremarkable to begin with. In other words, there are probably better ways to get people's blood pressure under control using exercise and dietary changes, losing weight, and, you know, and maybe even some nutrient stuff, as opposed to or any of the other thing, the osteopenia, you know, or osteoporosis. The bone density tests, as you say in the book, are designed to make it look like you're losing bone. And every woman that goes through menopause is going to lose some bone until she starts doing some exercise. So the question is really, should the, you know, the results are unremarkable with the drugs, and should people even get started with some of this stuff?
Well, I mean, I certainly can't answer that question because I'm simply a journalist. I'm not a physician, and wouldn't ever offer recommendations to individuals about that.
No, I mean, but you could say how you feel for yourself.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think my personal situation is not particularly important. I really don't write about myself in this issue. What I think is important here is to, I mean, you're right that sometimes drugs cause side effects that other drugs then fix. I guess I take a slightly different view. I don't necessarily think a lot of this is a conspiracy. I said in the book that this is no dark conspiracy. It's simply daylight robbery. I think that you know that when we talk about disease, I don't think, well, I know that drug companies are not inventing these illnesses. These conditions we're talking about are long established conditions. Many of the people suffering them experience genuine disability, and it's quite appropriate that they're described as medical conditions. What I'm concerned about is that the definitions are broadened so much that many healthy people are now caught in the net. But I think, again, here at this workshop this week, we've heard some extraordinary lectures about the controversies surrounding the anti-arthritis drugs, the COX-2s, and the way in which data has been manipulated. So when I say there's no conspiracy, that doesn't mean that sometimes there is actual straight-out data manipulation, and that does happen, and it happens often in that nexus, that relationship between pharmaceutical companies and senior researchers that they work with, who are often on the payroll. And there's been some quite despicable examples of that in recent times in the US and elsewhere, particularly around the antidepressants and very currently around these COX-2 anti-arthritis drugs.
I think you misunderstood what I meant. What I meant is not, I'm sure there are the other books that I cited at the beginning, I mean, the Truth About the Drug Companies and Overdosed America do talk about some real conspiracies, honest to God conspiracies. But what I'm talking about is what you talk about when you go into an audience and you offer the data in three different ways, and each way makes the numbers sound different. That's what I'm talking about.
Yes, look, we could talk about that briefly if you like. I mean, this is one of the most misleading things. When people are told that a drug, an osteoporosis drug, will cut their risk of fracture in half, which is technically correct, but really, I think, very misleading. Because if you look at the same data a slightly different way, what you will see is that the drug will cut the risk of hip fracture from 2% to 1%. So you could say accurately that that is a 50% reduction, but more accurately you would say that is a 1% reduction, or you would tell people that the drug could reduce their risk of hip fracture from 2% to 1% if they take the drug for 3 or 4 years. And that those figures are hypothetical, but they're used to make a point. And the point is that often the benefits of these preventive medicines are presented in ways that are misleading. And it's not just drug company advertisements that present them in a misleading way. It's news stories that you see in newspapers or on television will use that figure that we call it the relative risk reduction. We'll use that figure rather than the more appropriate absolute figures to really inform people. And that certainly is a fundamental problem in the way the benefits of these therapies are oversold to people. Yeah, you're right, Lena.
So we need to take a brief musical break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman in studio with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. And on the line, we have Ray Moynihan, M-O-Y-O-N-I-H-A-N, co-author with Alan Cassell, C-A-S-S-E-L-S, of the book Selling Sickness. We're going to take a very brief musical break. Please stay with us. We'll be right back.
I've got 90,000 pounds in my pajamas. I've got 40,000 French francs in my fridge. I've got lots of lovely lira now the Deutsche Mark's getting dearer, and my dollar bills would buy the Brooklyn Bridge. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money. There is nothing quite as beautiful as cash. Some people say it's folly, but I'd rather have the lolly. With money you can make a splash. There is nothing quite as wonderful as money.
Money, money, money.
There is nothing like a newly minted pound.
Money, money, money.
Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that waits the world around.
Round, round.
You can keep your Marxist ways, but it's only just a phrase. For it's money, money, money makes the world go round.
Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. That was Monty Python. If you missed parts of today's show, you can go to our website and listen to it all week at yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you'll also find information on the Progressive Health Observer and how to get a copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness. You can also call 707-874-2772. We're going to return to our interview with Roy Moynihan, M-O-Y-N-I-H-A-N, co-author of Selling Sickness. We're discussing how people are turned into patients. And yes, there you have it. The website for the publisher is actually the only website I have. Did you have a website that you wanted to give out for any reason?
No. The book's available on Amazon.com and so on.
No. This is Nation Books, and so it's nationbooks.org.
It is.
Yeah, could redirect you. Jeffrey had some questions, I believe.
Maybe a decade ago, Jeffrey Rose published a book called, a little small book called The Strategy for Preventive Medicine, in which he, he's a British physician, who rather takes to task the medicalization of prevention. And this may be as leaping ahead some to solutions for this problem. But again, this has to do with institutional structure. That one of the things that Dr. Rose argues is that prevention through medical practice is inappropriate. That in the epilogue to your book, you mentioned that things like designing cities better may be a much more effective and more appropriate strategy for dealing with the development of the chronic diseases that medical prevention is intended to treat, that it isn't even a question of whether someone's at high risk or low risk, or someone making an individual decision about whether they need to take a drug or not, or whether the doctor thinks they should take a drug, or whether the pharmaceutical companies invent something to prevent it, that we're just thinking about this institutionally in the wrong way, and that public health institutions need to become much more involved with the definition of health and disease. So I'm wondering if in the course of your writing the book, you had explored that issue.
Look, I feel embarrassed that I haven't drilled into this area and started looking at the data and researching and investigating. I've spent far too much time critiquing the strategies, the marketing strategies of the medical profession and the medical industrial establishment. And part of the problem for me is that I haven't spent enough time looking at all the non-medical, non-pharmacological ways of dealing with the major health problems that we have. And so I think that I think that the nexus between environment and health really is where the debate will start to move to. If reason is to win the day, I think that the way we design the cities obviously is a key one. I think our diets obviously are critical. The amount of physical activity involved in our lives, our general states of wellness and psychological health, all of these are critical factors. And I think there are real problems with our mindset. I think that we've equated medicine with health, and I think that's entirely problematic.
Right. Yes.
This is not my area of expertise. There are people with far more expertise than me, but just the brief amount of reading on this stuff that I've done, we could probably benefit greatly both as individuals and as communities if we put a lot more effort into looking at those more, I suppose, those more community or socially based approaches to health and medicine, rather than the commercialized, individualized, medicalized approaches to health issues that dominate the way we think today.
Yes. Well, let me ask another question that might be a little easier to answer. That in the course of your researching the book, one of the there's a lot of focus on pharmaceutical companies, and not to defend them, they make an easy target. Because it's fairly grotesque. But there's another piece to this, to the medicalization of health and prevention, which has to do with medical device manufacturers. If one watches virtually any of the numerous medical TV shows, people are constantly getting MRIs and CAT scans and PET scans, and it's my hypothesis that of a number of people, that we really haven't gotten better over the last 30 years at preventing people from dying. What we've gotten better at is mechanically keeping them alive. So I'm wondering if, in the course of your researching the book, you did any, you looked at all at the role of medical device manufacturers in this atmosphere of creating patients.
Sure. I think that the particularly diagnostic testing, is a real concern, and for a range of reasons. There's two things I want to say. I want to talk briefly about diagnostic testing, but secondly, just about the power of the device industry as well. But let's talk first about diagnostic testing, and as you mentioned, MRIs and CAT scans and so on. We all tend to think these things are benign. How could a test be problematic? How could a test be harmful? Unless, of course, it's an invasive test that has specific harms. But let's say the test itself doesn't actually hurt you physically in any way. It still can be extremely harmful because it can potentially give you a false sense that you are sick and lead you down a path towards interventions you don't need. And I think one example here, again, is osteoporosis, where you have had, along with the marketing of the osteoporosis drugs by the drug companies, you have had a concurrent marketing of bone density testing. Now, again, for some women, this may be a valuable test to have. But for many healthy women, the test does not necessarily give meaningful answers and can lead to them feeling as if they have an illness that then needs to be treated with drugs potentially they don't need and maybe potentially very harmful to them, not to mention the cost. So I think diagnostic testing is something people need to think a lot about. There's people up at Dartmouth, at the Dartmouth Medical School up in the northeast of the country, in Hanover, New Hampshire, who've done a lot on this issue. They've looked at the role of tests in medicine, and they've really started to come up with a whole thesis that sort of says the more you look, the more pathology you'll find, and you'll find more and more of it, and the better the tests are, the more you'll find, and you start finding stuff that you really, really don't need to find. And in fact, it becomes dangerous to find it because you start treating it and you run the risk of all the harms of treatment. So that is a major problem in terms of medical devices and so on. The second thing I just wanted to say is that you're right, the drug companies are an easy target. But many other vested interests are playing a role in medicine, and the device manufacturers are a key one. And so many surgeons in this country have close financial ties to the equipment manufacturers, just as physicians have ties to the drug industry. And so I understand that the federal authorities in Washington, and it could be the Justice Department, I'm not certain, but I know for a fact the federal authorities have recently been investigating the financial ties between surgeons and equipment makers, because the trouble is those ties can totally distort the decisions those surgeons make, not just about individual patients, but about decisions about what gear their hospital should buy, what equipment their hospital should buy. And so some of us would think that if a surgeon is making a decision between different sorts of equipment, it may be better that they're not paid by one of the equipment manufacturers. And these sorts of ties really should be a thing of the past.
The other problem with devices is that most of them do deliver doses, including bone density doses of ionizing radiation, and
that's
there's
right.
Lots of credible research that shows that ionizing radiation at any dose is unsafe. That you
that's
should,
right.
You know, if you get hit by a truck, yes, okay, you do, you know, maybe a CAT scan, but the rest of the time, that's exposing you to enough radiation so that it's like you were in Hiroshima a mile away when the bomb went off. So that's also making people sick. I mean, the study
that is right.
Yeah, John Goffman, etc.
Some people, I think, have even tried to quantify the number of x-rays, the number of scans, and compared that to what increase in your risk of cancer you might have. And so, yes, exposure to these tests in itself is harmful.
And there are tests that are done while you're under, before you have a procedure done, like fluoroscopy, that's also done with ionizing radiation. So it's tricky. The other thing, of course, about bone density is that they are set up to compare a woman to a 30-something-year-old woman. And any woman, as I said, that goes through menopause will temporarily lose some bone and then usually regrow it after her body stabilizes to some extent if she starts exercising. I did have one other question for you. You're from Australia. Alan Casals is Canadian. How does the United States and these other countries compare? How is it in Canada, for instance, where they have a sort of socialized medicine? Is it any better?
Look, I think it's a little better. Maybe I could talk about Australia a little bit. I know it's a long way from your listeners, but I mean, we have a 100% publicly funded universal healthcare system.
It's not going to be closed for long. Everybody's getting on a plane when they get off.
No, it's 14 hours. Don't try it unless you really, really want to. 14 hours, LA, Sydney. But
how many hours?
14.
14 is a lot. Yeah.
Take a long book. Take a beach book.
A long flight. But the point was just to say that one of the key differences between our system and yours, and it's the same in Canada, with Australia, we don't allow direct consumer advertising of drugs, prescription drugs.
Bless you.
That is a major difference between your system and our system. I mean, there are many differences, but we can talk about those. But one of the key ones here in terms of the marketing of illness, which you see every night on the TV news here, in the advertisements, we don't have that. Companies are able to put out information about diseases, not in the form of advertising, and certainly they do that, and that's problematic. But that's a major difference, and I think I think you'll see attempts to reform the system here gain strength in the coming years, but I certainly wouldn't hold my breath waiting for that reform to come to the United States.
To what extent is Australia like the United States? In the my understanding in the United States is that the vast bulk of advertising marketing funds, dollars, go to practitioners, not to consumer advertising and consumer marketing.
That's correct.
And is that the same in Australia?
It is the same. I mean, those marketing strategies are global, and the difference here is that you do have the direct to consumer advertising, and you're right, it's still only a small percentage of the total marketing and promotional budget. But you have to say it's a growing portion. In the last 10 years, particularly, the FDA loosened the rules in the late 1990s, and television advertising of prescription drugs became a lot more aggressive. And so the percentage of the money that drug companies spend on consumer advertising, it's growing, but it doesn't match what's spent on physicians. And the great bulk of the promotional budget actually is spent on drug representatives and free samples. And often drug representatives hand out free samples. And that, the last time I looked at the figures, which is maybe a year or two ago now, that was the big chunk of the promotional spend was on the drug reps and the free samples. And it's important to say that a lot of physicians, a lot of doctors, a lot of health professionals are starting to refuse to see drug representatives because they feel that it might distort their practice. And we're seeing that in Australia. We're seeing that here in the United States. We're seeing that in other places too. Some universities are saying all the education that we're going to run now, none of it is going to be funded by pharma. So there's sort of steps to try and change this underway.
You're listening to an interview with Roy Monahan, M-O-Y-N-I-H-A-N, who is co-author with Alan Cassells, C-A-S-S-E-L-S, of the book Selling Sickness. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Elena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D. You mentioned something about the growing resistance, and you talk about it in the book. How is this happening? Who is it who is the resistance?
Well, I think it's patchy. I think it's patchy and it's probably small at this point. But I think the level of concern about Big Pharma's influence, the level of concern within portions of the medical establishment is really growing rapidly. You know, the editors of the major medical journals, which of course we should mention, the journals themselves, even ones I write for, rely importantly on funds from the drug industry. So the British Medical Journal, which I write for regularly, I think takes maybe 20% of its total income from the pharmaceutical industry through advertising. I think the figures in this country would be much higher. The big medical journals rely heavily on drug advertising. But having said that, the medical journal editors themselves are increasingly concerned and outraged about a lot of the marketing tactics that we've been discussing. And more importantly, about the way the research itself is being distorted, the way data is covered up and manipulated and so on. So there is growing concern. What's being done about it is another question. One example I point to, though, is the American Medical Student Association. That might sound like a small, unimportant group, but in fact they have 50,000 members, the American Medical Students Association, 50,000 members across this country. They decided several years ago to have a pharma-free policy, and that doesn't mean their members don't prescribe drugs. What it means is that they ask their members not to accept drug company money, not to accept paid consultancies, not to accept trips away, not to accept free meals, not to accept pens or anything. And that policy is a very hard, strict policy. They've been influenced by several activists in this field. They've adopted that as a policy. And again, last time I checked, that's the one they had, and they were very proud of. Now, unless that's changed in the interim, that still stands. And I think, given those students are the physicians of tomorrow, maybe some of this will change.
One of the other considerations for the consumer in this atmosphere that we find ourselves in, where prevention means medication and where symptoms mean a diagnosis, is that there is a problem now getting a diagnosis. If you get a diagnosis, you're uninsurable. If you have more than one diagnosis, or if the insurance companies can find any reason to exclude you, they will. So where this is where people are getting turned down because they have flat feet for insurance.
Sure.
That if you are taking these medications, you are considered to be somebody at risk who has a risk factor, and they may not take you.
That's the flip side, Lenny. You're absolutely right. The flip side of this problem is that when you know, often when people genuinely are ill and in desperate need of treatment, they may not be able to get that treatment reimbursed by their insurer. And that is a particular problem in
well,
this
may,
country.
They may not be able to get an insurer,
yes,
is what
well,
I'm saying. They may yeah, not even
oh,
be allowed to. They won't even an insurer won't take them. You know, it seems very benign. Your doctor says, "Oh, look, you know, your blood pressure's a little high, and so we'll give you this." And then your cholesterol, we don't like it, so we'll get to the. Pretty soon, this person has two diagnoses and can't get insurance. And in addition to that, you know, with this driving down of standards, of the you know the current level of cholesterol, what they're expecting people to have is. You cite Malcolm Kendrick in your book. You don't talk about his cohort, Ufi Ravenskov, who wrote the book The Cholesterol Myths. He's a PhD MD who went through all of the research on cholesterol and could not find anything in any of the credible research, you know, years and years and years of it, that actually points to an increase of heart disease or death from high cholesterol levels. So one of the other problems is if you lower people's cholesterol too low, you bring about other problems like a loss of immune function and inability to make sex hormones and psychiatric symptoms from too little fat or cholesterol. Cholesterol is not fat, but people suddenly not eating any. So you sort of create a whole, as I said, a whole cascade of other symptoms that then get treated with other drugs, which create other symptoms, which get treated by other drugs, not very efficiently. So.
Yes.
So there's the issue of who makes the decision about what the standard should be before we started that at the beginning. But when did cholesterol levels need to be 150 all of a sudden? I mean, that's absurd.
Well, the point, just an interesting little fact about the definitions of cholesterol is that the panel that makes the decision, the panels that decide what constitutes treatable high cholesterol, the panel, 8 of the 9 people that made the most recent decision in 2004, 8 of the 9 people had multiple financial ties to a range of large companies, many of which produced cholesterol-lowering drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably becoming well known now. But that panel is not unusual. If you look across any specialty in medicine, you'll find that the senior specialists, the most respected researchers, often have ties to the drug companies. So that's a real problem, those panels, and that's one thing that could change. Is that those panels could have less people with such conflicts of interest on them. Your other point, just briefly about insurance, again, part of that problem is a function of the market-based system that the United States has, which is a fairly unique system in the developed world. As you and your listeners probably know, you have the largest share of your healthcare pie that run within the private sector. And you also have the largest share of GDP that goes to health. I think it's around 15%. So you spend more than anyone else. It's probably the least efficient and least fair system in the world. And one of the problems is that people in genuine need sometimes can't get the treatment they need.
I'd like to. You're absolutely right. Way to go. I wanted to just take in a, make a comment about the issue of panels and then ask you a question. The comment is, I think my recollection is correct, that when this issue of eight of the nine panelists on the cholesterol standards board being heavily connected with industry came up, the chair of the panel said, well, if we eliminated those people, we wouldn't have any experts to be on the panel, which was kind of this admission that everybody's in the game. But in your epilogue, you have a discussion of how to put these panels together. And you mentioned some health advocacy groups and independent organizations. I'm wondering, two things. One is, who is campaigning for this change in panels, or is there anyone campaigning for these changes? And do you think that it would be appropriate to broaden people on panels to include things like social justice groups? Because we know from the work of people like Michael Marmot that social class has a profound influence on disease. So maybe the panels not only need to be MDs or disease-specific groups, but more broadly, people who and groups who we don't really think of as being health groups per se.
I think that's a very interesting idea. I think that you know, we've got to start thinking about the social determinants of health. If we are genuinely motivated to decrease the burden of disease, to increase the health of the community, you know, we have to look outside this traditional box of healthcare, which in America, you know, that box includes physicians and all the other health professionals and so on. And I think you know you have to start looking at and indeed innovative health strategies in some parts of the world, probably in America as well, will include you know, the departments of justice, the departments, the local police force, the local you know, employment people who deal with employment and education.
Yeah, we're going to have to. I'm sorry.
Fine.
We have to leave it there.
Thank you so much.
We're completely out of time. Ray Moynihan, Moynihan, Ray Moynihan, Selling Sickness. I want to thank you so much for your participation in this show, and good luck with your book.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, or the Progressive Health Observer, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, where you can listen all week to the show. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness is Michael Yoshida. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.